Welcome to the Debate at GOI podcast series. Today we'll be talking to national security expert Vice Admiral Jonathan Meade, the Chief of the Nuclear Powered Submarine Task Force. He joined the Royal Australian Navy almost 40 years ago and has experienced numerous sea postings and saw active service in the North Arabian Gulf and was appointed as a member of the Order of Australia for his exceptional service in warlike conditions. On promotion to Rear Admiral in 2015, he spent 3 years as the head of Navy capability in Canberra. From January 2018 to November 2020, Vice Admiral Meade served as the commander of the Australian fleet. Hello, my name's Ron Cantlars. I'm a freelance journalist and producer, and throughout this series, we've been canvassing a range of topics touching upon the work of all the Group of Eight universities. They include the Australian National University, Monash University, UNSW Sydney, the Universities of Adelaide, Melbourne, Sydney, Queensland, and Western Australia. Also in the studio with me is Vicky Thompson, the CEO of the Group of Eight universities. Well, firstly, Vice Admiral Jonathan Meade, thanks for taking part in this podcast. You wrote an op-ed in The Australian some 18 months ago talking about AUKUS, and you said that the delivery of a project of this scale is a national endeavour. We must get this right. To do so, we must have the right people with the right skill sets in the right places. How do we get those people?
Well, I think what I wrote 18 months ago, Ron, is just as relevant now as it will be into the future. And clearly, developing a suitably qualified and experienced workforce is one of the big challenges. The Deputy Prime Minister has indicated that there'll be 20,000 job opportunities over the next 20 to 30 years around Australia. And we need to build a skilled workforce that will enable us to develop a sovereign capability to build our own submarines, to acquire submarines, to maintain them, to be able to sustain them through life, and our ability to have technical governance of those submarines. So an incredible amount of work has already taken place with our partners. And we started this nearly 2 years ago. We in 2021, placed students in Australian universities, UNSW and ANU, on nuclear engineering and master's courses. We currently have at the moment 11 naval officers overseas undergoing nuclear reactor training. Another six will leave in a month, and at the end of the year we'll have about another dozen junior sailors. Now, I know they are small numbers, and it's far broader than the Navy. We see the developing of this workforce in probably six fundamental areas. First of all, developing the Navy workforce. The next one is the industry workforce, and that's going to be crucial for us, obviously. Then is the public sector. We currently have 45 public sector members undergoing nuclear training overseas and in Australia. There is the tertiary sector, the vocational sector, and then the sector with our AUKUS partners.
You mentioned that the big numbers, 20,000 people, but this is technology foreign to this country in terms of nuclear technology. How do you get past that big hurdle?
So from the very beginning, our AUKUS partners have leaned in heavily to assist Australia developing a capability, and then as we do so, to develop a sovereign nuclear capability, a capability that we can be appropriate nuclear stewards to manage nuclear technology. As I said, we have a number of students overseas, but we're working with the universities, the G8 and other universities right now around Australia on how we can build up this workforce so that we will be ready in 2027 to receive US and UK submarines that will be operating from HMAS Stirling. So we'll be ready by the end of the decade to commence build of our first SSN AUKUS down in South Australia. We'll be ready in the 2030s to be sovereign ready and to acquire Virginia-class submarines from the United States, and then in the early 2040s, deliver our own nuclear submarines as a sovereign capability.
So in your words, what does AUKUS mean for Australia? What's the potential of this trilateral agreement? How important is it to our defence future, but also our economic future?
I mean, AUKUS from the very beginning had a really significant geostrategic element to it. It was the three partners coming together at a time in order to respond to the change in the circumstances of the region. We saw that the region had become less stable and more fragile, and the Australian government responded accordingly to develop a capability, a nuclear-powered submarine capability, which remit was quite simple: to defend Australia, protect our people, and ensure our economic prosperity. And that's really the strategic elements of that. And then when we get into what does the AUKUS mean, it means the three countries coming together, harnessing each other's industrial base, our workforce. I went to the United States in April. I spoke to many of my counterparts in the Pentagon. I spoke to and spoke with Congress. I went to the shipyard at Norfolk, the largest shipyard in the world, and then I went to MIT and I spoke to them. They have a nuclear reactor in the middle of Boston there, part of the MIT, and I asked how we could work with them in developing courses to get Australia, to get defence people and industry people nuclear ready.
Do you think that our universities are leaning in a positive way to this discussion? Because obviously you've outlined those six areas, and it's not just all about universities, of course. There's a whole pipeline of capability that will be needed. But I guess, you know, from my perspective, the eight universities that I represent certainly have a lot of capacity, I guess, for capability building. And it sort of goes back to Ron's question really at the beginning, because you've got to bring people through and be engaged and excited by what we're presenting. And we've also got to do things in real time. So there's a bit of a challenge there. And I'm just wondering whether you're seeing from the university sector that engagement that you'd like to see, or is there more that we could be doing?
The G8 have been fantastic to start with, Vicky, and from as soon as the announcement was made in September 2021, we injected many students into the UNSW and the AMU programs. We essentially flooded their systems, and the vice chancellors and the staff at both universities, as an example, have been tremendous, and we are getting a terrific buy-in when we go around the country and talk to respective universities, either within the G8 or outside the G8, about how they can assist us. But I mean, at the very heart of this, we really need the universities to be able to attract and retain STEM students so that they can support the nuclear program. As part of the AUKUS announcement in March, the government indicated that there would be 4,000 Commonwealth-supported places over the next 4 years. I think there are significant opportunities for defence to work with whole of government, the Department of Education and the universities to really begin to use AUKUS as a mechanism to stimulate the STEM sector. And I say that because, you know, right now there is probably a 15-year-old student doing her homework. Hopefully it should be doing STEM subjects, but it matters not. But one day, she'll be the future commanding officer of a nuclear-powered submarine. Her friends will be her shipmates. She will have other people that she knows that will be working in the yard at South Australia to help build the submarine, and some of their friends could be over Western Australia supporting, visiting US submarines or working in laboratories in Australia or overseas. I really think that AUKUS is a moment in time that really brings together the importance of STEM and the university sector. And I give you an example. We advertised very recently in the Nuclear Power Submarine Task Force for 11 different job families, and we received over 4,000 responses in a matter of weeks. When I go overseas to the US and the UK and I ask them, what is it that keeps your people for such long periods in the program? And they say to me that it is that sense of working with the most advanced technology in the world and doing something for their country. And I truly believe that we should harness that, we should exploit that, And I think that that would really be a force multiplier for the universities, for the Australian economy, for the community in Australia, and clearly for the AUKUS program. Mm.
I totally agree with that. I guess the challenge is, though, particularly in those STEM areas, we already have a shortage, put aside any capability development in defence. And I just wonder then, if you get all these kids coming through, which is fantastic, and you get the applicants as you are you then sucking up from other sectors capability? You know, we still need roads built and bridges built, et cetera. So I understand and completely support and agree with the capability building of an industry sector, but I just wonder, and I know your single focus is on delivering, and so that's your focus, but I just wonder if you've got any views on how do we ensure that we actually, everyone gets a piece of that pie, I guess.
No, I agree. And we certainly don't want to be robbing Peter to pay for Paul on this. AUKUS is a whole of government capability program. The task force it really comprises members from Prime Minister and Cabinet, DFAT, Attorney General's Education. I would not be seeing, and I do not intend to draw upon from the existing pie and say AUKUS needs to fit within that. I think part of my remit is and responsibility is to make that pie bigger for everyone and so that we can all draw from a larger pool of people. And I think that the AUKUS program, the narrative that I was born in South Australia and I was only there yesterday, will become one of the most complex and advanced technology hubs in the world, is a story that we need to tell young people in Australia and our students, which attracts them into the STEM, so that that pool of people grows over time.
Brings me to another point. I mean, we talk about the job prospects and the skills prospects from AUKUS, but at the end of the day, it's a weapon of war. I'm interested in your previous position as commander of the Australian fleet. What is it about a nuclear submarine that is so powerful, so lethal, that the government has embraced it in this trilateral deal?
That's an excellent question, Ron. The US uses the term that they are the apex predator of the oceans. Submarines have always been a very formidable defence capability. The Collins-class submarines at the moment are the most advanced conventional submarines in the world, and they have provided terrific service to this country, and the men and women who serve in those submarines have done an outstanding job. Nuclear power submarines deliver a new dimension in capability. They can remain submerged for months on end. They can operate close to the homeland or further afield undetected. And then if they require, they can deliver significant strike power. So they have multiple roles, deterrence being one of them, but also strike power. They can undertake intelligence, surveillance, reconnaissance missions. But at the end of the day, so their key role is to defend Australia, protect our people and safeguard our economic way of life and our prosperity. And you know, certainly all the countries, with all of our partners, are embracing and have embraced nuclear-powered submarines as really the cutting edge. Nuclear-powered submarines, in a way, place the greatest element of doubt in that adversary's mind.
And yet, I noticed that you've had to constantly defend the project from people like the former Prime Minister Paul Keating, who said that if we get these submarines, only a third will be operational at any point. Is he right? And what impact does that have on our capacity to defend Australian shores?
So the aim of all defence capability is to have them in a state of readiness so that they can respond to government direction. And it is also right that all defence capabilities around the world require a degree of maintenance. I mean that just makes sense, particularly with complex programs such as ships, submarines and aircraft. But as I said, the focus is having all those elements in a state of readiness that they can deliver the requirements of the government of the day if needed.
Another question I want to ask you also is that you talked about the lethal capacity of these subs. You refer to them as the apex predators, but they are nuclear powered with nuclear reactors. How do you convince the Australian public that they are safe?
I think one of my roles is to clearly talk to the Australian public about how safe these submarines are. So we have had over 280 visits from nuclear-powered submarines and ships to Australia without incident over the past 50 years. As you know, we operate a research nuclear reactor, severe nuclear reactor, in Sydney at Lucas Heights for the past 70 years. The US and the UK have operated over 500 nuclear reactors in their defence forces. Their submarines have travelled the distance to the moon and back. These reactors will come to us in a welded, shielded and sealed unit that will not be open for the lifetime of the submarine. The number one priority of the program is nuclear safety, and that is safety of the crew, safety of the community and the protection of the environment. And I'll give you one item, just one data point of fact. A sailor in an American nuclear-powered submarine receives 1/30th the dosage of radiation than what you and I do through our normal business in South Australia or in Canberra. It's trying to highlight the absolute primacy that Australia has and will place on safety and security throughout the whole program. I think that is one of my real mandates given to me by government.
And how's that going?
I think it's going well, but I never act complacent about that. I think this is one of those areas that we need to continue to talk to the Australian public on and to our regional partners about the safety, the inherent safety safeguards that are in the nuclear program. As I mentioned, I was down in South Australia yesterday and, you know, had a wide range of discussions and talks with government officials and also with community leaders. And at one moment I'm dealing with how to build a nuclear-powered submarine, how to work with our partners on acquiring nuclear-powered submarines. And in the same day, I'm listening to community leaders about such aspects, about playgrounds, which may be affected by the build of a submarine. And my job is to listen and to understand all of those reach-outs and voices, and to the best of my ability to be able to address their concerns, whether they are safety concerns, geostrategic issues, or matters such as playgrounds.
So it's a pretty big job. Did you think this was going to be kind of what you'd be doing when you signed up?
Well, I joined the Navy nearly 40 years ago.
Yeah, so exactly.
I didn't think about it when I was 18, Vicky. But certainly been working in the program the last 2 years. It's been an exciting journey. I think it's a journey that is, and I don't want to overuse this phrase because it does get thrown around often, but this to me is truly a national endeavour. It will require confidence within all sectors of Australia, public sector, community, industry, unions, academia, within defence, and also within our partners as well. That is a full-time job.
Yeah. One of the things that I think is particularly significant with this agreement, and I do understand that you're not looking after AUKUS Pillar 2, but for the layman out there, I think that a lot of the attention is focused on the kit, the submarine, the build. We hear a lot about workforce, but there is this significant underpinning with these eight priority areas, which, we have a lot of capability in Australia existing already and the potential to build that capability. I guess my question to you then is, how important is the success of AUKUS Pillar 2 to the success of AUKUS Pillar 1, if you like?
When we developed the partners, the AUKUS program, we deliberately linked the two pillars together. We actually wanted to bring in those areas that you just sort of mentioned, cyber, AI, electronic warfare, undersea warfare, hypersonics. We wanted to bring them in under an AUKUS environment that the three countries can maximise the skills, the S&T that they have within in order for us to work as a collective. So just as the industrial bases of the three countries, the shipyards and maintenance for nuclear-powered submarines can be harnessed together, we see the same logic and thinking happening in the PIL 2 areas as well. And as you know, Australia is very, very well advanced in a number of those areas which have been picked up in Pillar 2. The Defence Strategic Review made particular mention of Pillar 2, and also in the priority areas, government has indicated, you know, disruptive technologies, which really falls in that Pillar 2 area there, is one of their priorities.
It's fascinating listening to all the complexities of this, but one of the issues that has been raised by some defence experts who we've spoken to on debate at GO8, they question whether nuclear-powered submarines will be what we need in 30 years' time, given the lag times to build these things. Based on the rapid changes that we see in the community, how can you guarantee that this device will be up to specifications in a very changing world technologically?
The Australian Defence Force, the Department of Defence writ large, is always looking ahead, always looking to push the boundaries of science and technology to see what future capabilities are on the horizon. We're doing that with our AUKUS partners as well. But we've also had a very clear-eyed focus that nuclear-powered submarines have been, are, and will be the leading sort of deterrent capability for our country and for the partners. So we do this in parallel. We do this in developing capabilities for the future, but we're also have our eyes on those other technologies that we could bring to bear to complement the nuclear-powered submarine capabilities. And I think that's what Vicky mentioned before. That's clearly areas such as the Pillar 2, I think, actually acts as a complement. And you could, for instance, autonomous vehicles, nuclear-powered submarines are quite large. They're up to 10,000 tonnes. Employing autonomous vehicles from nuclear-powered submarines in the future clearly is an opportunity for us to look into.
So the project's been described as a marathon, not a sprint. When are we realistically likely to see the first of the nuclear-powered submarines?
So in some aspects, it's a T20 game. In some aspects, it's very much five-day test cricket. Some of these timelines that we have committed to as three nations are very ambitious. 2027, that's only 3.5 years away, US and UK nuclear-powered submarines will be operating from HMAS Stirling. That requires us to establish infrastructure at Garden Island HMAS Stirling, and the government has committed to $2 billion over the next couple of years in order for that to happen. We're looking at establishing a workforce there and a regulatory system to host that. And by 2029, building our first submarine down in South Australia, that will see, in the fullness of time, 8,500 people employed in building and maintaining these submarines. So I would say it is neither a sprint or a marathon, but in fact it is two sides of the same coin.
How invested are the UK and the US in this program? Because there have been stories more recently about a level of reticence within the US Congress. Are you concerned about that? Do you see that as a potential problem?
I went to the US in April and spoke to Congress. From what I've seen, from what I have been told, from the people that I communicate with, there is a real commitment, a genuine commitment and momentum in the Congress and the US to support AUKUS. And as you probably know, there is a AUKUS caucus around there and a number of people that are driving this really hard. Minister Conroy is over there right now, and he indicated that he had just been to Congress and saw there was incredibly strong bipartisan support for the AUKUS program. In fact, the support that we're seeing through with AUKUS is so strong now that there is a real sense that we could look into potentially changing some of the export control measures that have been in existence for some time in order to facilitate the AUKUS program. I'm going back to the US in July. I'm going back to the UK in July. I see a genuine commitment from my UK counterparts, all the people that I talk to, and I see it at all different levels, whether it be at government or down in the shipyards. I think there is real support for this and they understand the importance of it.
So as I think you and I were having a discussion just recently, and you may have seen a podcast that we did previously with retired Admiral Paul Madison. So what I found in the US, and I'm dealing at such a low level, I appreciate that, but I'm talking to my university counterparts, for example, and what I see is I feel that in Australia we have really leaned in as a sector. We're working very coherently together. This is a priority. It is absolutely a priority for our universities. I know that. There's not too many discussions that I don't have with my university leaders, and we are talking about pillar one, pillar two, capability, workforce. I didn't get that same sense when I was talking to my counterparts in the UK and US. What I got was, we've got a very sophisticated defence ecosystem, and it's almost because it is quite separate. So they do quarantine a lot of that, that research on campus, but it is quite separate. It's not as sort of porous as it is for us, I guess. And there are still some regulatory barriers across joint research, and I appreciate this isn't your domain, but to hear that, there are some breakthroughs in terms of ITARs and regulatory barriers is really important. But I still think, and it may be incumbent upon our universities to lean in a bit more with our UK and US counterparts, there's still a bit of work to be done to get them as excited, perhaps, at a scale is what I'm talking about. Not institutionally. You talked about MIT. I know UNSW, Arizona State, King's College London. So institutionally things are happening. But when we're looking at how do we break down some of those policy barriers, that's where we can really come into our kind of own. And I think there is still a little bit of work to do in that regard. They're my observations. I'm not asking you the question.
Yeah, they were terrific observations. I made note of them. The US university system has been supporting the nuclear program now for 70 years.
Exactly.
They are deeply invested in it. How has the AUKUS changed their thinking? They would say, hey, lean in on this, and I think that certainly universities that we've spoken to in the US have been absolutely forward leading. I mean, I said MIT are developing a course for a whole of government to attend, and same with the UK. I said the university UK sector has been supporting their nuclear power program for many decades. I think the change that we have here in Australia is this is very new to Australian universities, and I genuinely thank you and the other universities for leaning in on the AUKUS program and providing and asking, what can we do? How do we assist the AUKUS program? Because we think there is significant opportunities, and I think that that's terrific that you and others have taken up that mantle.
Finally, a question to you personally, sir. I've looked at your career. It's a remarkable career, commander of the Australian fleet. But this is the pinnacle, I would have thought, of your career. How you must be on a massive learning curve, for one, but also there must be a sense of great national responsibility that rests on your shoulders. How are you dealing with it all?
Ron, every day multiple things come across my desk which I know little about, and I have to lean in and research myself or ask others. I think there's one thing that there can be no place for in our program, and that's hubris. And from the very beginning, multiple people and agencies and governments and organisations have leaned in, and we have been, I think, very accepting. And I think the first thing is to acknowledge what our level of understanding is of nuclear-powered submarine, nuclear technology. to not be afraid to say, we need assistance, we need help here. And I said, every day things come across my desk. It could be on stewardship, safety, non-proliferation, the technical issues with the reactor, playgrounds.
Playgrounds.
About the nuances of playgrounds and that. And I think that's our role is we should never, ever say that we have no more to learn. Because I think if we got in that state of mind, that would indicate a degree of false arrogance that I think would actually undermine what we're trying to do here. And I think from our partners as well, when you talk to them, they have a very conservative approach. They never say that they have nothing more to learn. I think there is massive opportunities. As you said, I'm in my nearly 40th year in the Defence Force. This has certainly been the most demanding and challenging, but certainly the most rewarding program. It's certainly the one that's had the greatest national significance there. There is a fantastic team working at, not just in the Department of Defence, but elsewhere in the whole of government. And then as we work into with the university sectors and with industry, I mean, I walk away from the meetings I had, particularly yesterday in South Australia. I'm just invigorated by the enthusiasm and excitement that people that are sort of not in my direct area, but elsewhere, what they're exhibiting at the moment. I think it's a great time to be part of this endeavour.
Well, it's Admiral Jonathan Mead, thank you very much for your time and best of luck for the future. And thanks for taking part in this podcast today.
Thanks, Ron. Thanks, Vicky.
Thanks, Jonathan.
Thanks for your company today. If you'd like more information about the issues raised in this podcast or other related topics, please visit our website at go8.edu.au. And a quick reminder that you can always tune in to the debate at GO8 on Spotify, Google, Apple, or YouTube. Bye for now.